band is your band, this band is the medium wave band, or more likely the broadband actually. Hello, and welcome to another edition of Big Mouth, the pop culture show for people who love music, film, TV, books, and similar stuff, possibly a bit too much. My name's Andrew Harrison, and today we'll be looking at the remake of Alex Haley's Roots from the A&E network, which has just started on BBC Four. Listeners of a certain age, which means all of you, will remember the searing story of Kunta Kinte and how it rewrote America's ideas of slavery and its own dark history. Does the new version, starring British actor Malachi Kirby as the young African who lives through the horrors of abduction and slavery, make more or less sense in the age of Black Lives Matter? And is it possible to watch something like this purely for entertainment? We'll also be looking at the life and legacy of David Axelrod, the jazz soul visionary whose cosmic music of the late 1960s found unlikely echoes in the hip-hop and breakbeat music of the 90s and beyond. Axelrod died this week. We'll be talking about his music, his career, and what it all meant. And we'll be listening to the new album by Sampha, the Frank Ocean of Cricklewood. How does it fit into the burgeoning galaxy of new soul, and is it any good? As usual, it's a room full of white British people talking about black culture. First up, let's say hello to our guests for the show. Making his Big Mouth debut is the editor of men's style magazine Umbrella, Ella Ella, and head of content for the English watchmaker Chris Ward. It's Anthony Teasdale. Hello, Tony T. How are you?
I'm absolutely fine. Absolutely. I'm the one in here who's drinking coffee out of an old school mug rather than a paper one. So you're all sort of like Carrie Bradshaw. And I'm like Steptoe and Son.
There we are.
Standards, though, Tony.
Absolutely,
standards.
Yes. Anthony has been a Balearic DJ, a chronicler of casual football culture, a correspondent and deputy editor for FHM, and you've also written for Gratia as well, haven't you?
Everything.
Now he keeps the holy trinity of music, football and clobber alive. What happened to the intersection of music, football and clothes then? It seemed to dissolve, didn't it?
Yeah, I think sometime in about 1988, people who had worn extremely pretentious clothes at football matches started wearing them in slightly less pretentious nightclubs, and it sort of ended. But I think what's really interesting now is that there's lots of people who are the sons of the original casuals.
You say wearing scally dad offspring.
Yeah, so yes. So what's interesting is they are wearing the clothes of their fathers.
Literally,
the hand-me-downs. Do you know what I mean? It's like it's like me dressing up as Bill Haley in the 80s.
Well, actually, I have occasionally, when I've been up to see my mum and dad, my dad will be in the back garden doing the gardening in a Public Enemy t-shirt or an Aphex Twin baseball cap at one point. Tell us a little bit about Umbrella. What is Umbrella?
So Umbrella is produced by me. And a friend of mine called Matt Reynolds. It came about in a pub, as these good things tend to do. And we wanted to write about things like buses and trams and secret tunnels and tickets and maps with pretentious clothing. And we'd had this, a hunch that the sort of chap who liked a pretentious £300 jumper was also quite interested in nationalised bus services of the 90s, 70s. And so it proved to be.
Did you do the tunnels under Liverpool?
We haven't done those yet. I mean, I can tell you the James Street Underground in Liverpool is the oldest deep-level tube in the world, older than London Underground. Deep-level.
You're listening to Big Mouth, the pop culture broadcast there. Yeah. Also with us, returning to Big Mouth, he's a writer and DJ with deep connections to the grime and electronic scenes. He's put together some of the best-received dubstep albums in the early years of that sound. He's also been editorial boss of the international DJ hub Boiler Room. Now he writes for Mixmag, The Wire, Fact and The Question, and anybody else will have him. It is Joe Muggs. Hello, Joe. How are you today?
Hello, Andrew. I'm not so bad,
jolly,
actually.
Yeah. Jolly good. What's going on in the world of the grimes, then, that you have championed?
The world of the grimes, I've just been sent a grime album that is about the responsibilities of fatherhood. Grime is growing up.
How interesting, because that was my next little thing, because it's been around for a while. You know, so Dizzy's like 15 years in the game now, isn't he? Wiley's coming back like the granddad of grime.
Well, I did a piece on Wiley's greatest moments. I was digging back, and of course, he's been an MC for 20 plus years. He was in the jungle scene before grime. You know, yeah. These guys have been around the block.
Also with us, you heard him for a moment there. Without him, we would have no show at all. It is the one man, Stock Aitken and Waterman of podcast. It's Matt Hall, our producer. Hello, Matt. How are you today?
If I'm the hitman, does that make you Michaela Strachan?
Yeah, the hitman and increasingly hairless. Matt, you're a hip hop man. Can you get the grime? Can you get the grime, or is it for the youth people?
Yeah, because you know a lot of the fun originally for me with hip hop was kind of trying to decipher the lyrics and lyrical references, and it's exactly the same with grime. You know, it's people who can kind of ride a beat and say something, essentially saying how good they are and how rubbish other people are in lots of new and interesting ways.
I always thought one thing that nobody ever talked about, even from the very, very, very dawn of hip-hop, one thing nobody ever talked about is how very good value the records are. There's a lot in.
I used to love it when hip-hop albums came with lyric sheets.
Yeah.
They used to be printed in kind of like 0.5 point.
Yeah, nano type.
And it went on forever. It was
not dad-friendly, that.
Absolutely. You know, I kind of, compared to like a rock record telling you to hold on and, over and over again for 6 minutes, you get a lot of content, don't you? Very content-rich.
Yeah, it does happen to be about the same three subjects, but as I say, if it's good, it's good.
Is there a giant Webster's dictionary of collected, the greatest hip-hop lyrics of all time available for sort of digest at all?
There should be. If there isn't, there
Big
should
Mouth
be.
Publications coming up soon. All right, let's get cracking with the new TV version of Roots, which began this week on BBC Four, still available on iPlayer if you didn't see it. The original adaptation of Alex Haley's novel of the African-American experience in 1977 was one of the most powerful TV experiences ever. It was the first show ever to be nominated in every acting category in the Emmys. One episode became, for a time, the highest-rated TV show ever in America. It was eventually beaten only by the finale of MASH and the Who Shot JR episode of Dallas. For many Americans, Roots started the conversation about slavery and America's foundation, which still reverberates today. This remake appeared on the History Channel in the US in the middle of a rancorous presidential campaign. Now it's on BBC Four. Before we talk about it, let's have a listen to a bit of Roots.
You can't buy a slave. You got to make a slave.
They treat you like an animal till you strike like one.
Don't matter what the master call you. You keep your true name inside.
They can put the chains on your body. Never let them put the chains on your mind.
You here to keep this family going, to survive.
No, I wasn't born in pain.
You ain't never seen a fighter like me before.
I won't never see you be my equal.
Don't have no interest in being your equal.
Keep moving north and don't ever look back.
Now I'll ask you again. Tell me your name.
I'm Kunta Kinte.
Excerpts from the new remake of Roots on BBC Four at the moment. I mean, it's brutal stuff, isn't it? It's actually properly sickening to watch.
And,
Anthony Teasdale, you were saying you watched it this morning over your breakfast. No, you look a bit pale.
Yeah, well, so I got up and thought, well, I've got to be professional to actually watch this. You know, I'm not going to make a change. Do you know what I mean?
You obviously haven't heard this show before.
So for the first half hour, I thought, oh, this is quite good. This looks great. This is quite exciting. There's a nice family story.
The first half hour set entirely in the Gambia, isn't it?
Yeah,
it's
yeah.
Like the world of Africa.
Yeah, a lot of people been on their holidays there. This is all right. This is like, it was a bit like, there was an element of that, oh, this is quite a good adventure story, and where is our hero going to go? And everyone's been on the protein shakes. Everyone's like really muscly. Mm. And you think, okay, this is real. Oh, that's interesting. I'm learning a bit. And then it goes unremittingly, awfully horrible. I found after about 40 minutes, I found it really, really difficult to watch because seeing, all right, they're not real people and they're actors, but seeing, things
they
that were
real events.
They are real events and, they were done, and the English are named. And it's grim and I found it very hard to watch. I did watch it, but it was.
Well, Alex Haley synthesised the story. There was actually a lawsuit around it, wasn't there? Because he was accused of plagiarising certain aspects of it, but he did synthesise the story of Kunta Kinte. It's sort of like 80% one story with some additions to kind of produce a rounded image of what it would be like to be that guy abducted, sold into slavery, dropped into the abyss. you know, the big question of this is, of course, you know, is it possible to watch something like this for entertainment? As Anthony's just said, Joe, what did you think of this?
It's hard to have an opinion because you feel like you're reviewing slavery.
I know, slavery. Is it a bad
thing? Let's make an aesthetic judgment.
It's a bit dull in the middle.
Lovely message of hope. No, there wasn't a message of hope at all.
Yeah.
You know, it was flayed skin and salt, literally salt in the wounds.
Yeah.
And
if there's a message of hope, it's like people might get around to sorting this out in 200 years, possibly. Yeah.
Yeah. And there'll still be repercussions after that.
Yeah.
And all of the rest of it. I mean, I quite like very, very horrible films.
Yeah.
And even this was, you know, it was just so... doesn't let anybody off the hook.
Yeah. I mean, it is brilliantly mounted, brilliantly put together. It looks gorgeous. There's been, actual fortune spent. And in the opening episode, the three phases we go from, as Anthony just said, you're in Africa, you're in the Gambia. Then there's the sequence on the slave ship where you see in forensic detail what it was like to be manacled for a voyage, what it was like to see people thrown overboard because they were ill and wouldn't be good merchandise. Just horrendous. And then we arrive in the Virginia tobacco plantation and things get even more horrendous. We meet Forrest Whitaker as Fiddler, I think we have to refer to him on the radio as the House Negro, but that wasn't the term used at the time, the guy who's made his accommodations. And having seen all this horrendous physical body horror and sadism, you then see the psychological horror of people who've had to, they've had to capitulate.
Yeah. I mean, I think actually it was grim and really, really difficult to watch. And like Anthony, after about the halfway mark, I was like, man, this is kind of, gritting my teeth a bit to get through this. I think actually it was probably, if anything, it's probably a bit sugar-coated. There's a attempted kind of, on the boat during the Middle Passage, the slaves attempt to rebel, and that's kind of beaten back, and a few of them are chucked overboard, but not, I thought they kind of got off a bit lightly there.
There's
in a way.
A fair few cannonballs through chests, arms lopped off.
Yeah. But then there's a bit where at the end of the, I'm sorry if this is a spoiler. There's a bit at the end of the first episode where the Kinte gets attempts to escape and gets brought back, and he gets the skin off his flayed off his back. Yeah. I don't know whether or not that had happened, or whether they just string him up.
That is one of the iconic scenes in the original, isn't it?
Yeah.
But he is the hinge of the entire story is that Kunta Kinte is christened Toby as a slave, and he will christened named Toby as a slave, and he will not accept the slave name, and he's flayed, and he told her the whipping will stop if he says his name is Toby, and he won't. And I remember that, you know, I think because I've not seen the original since it went out, I'm sure I remember that taking place. And it just seems to be the hinge of the whole story. You know, you're going to, it's about the dehumanization of people.
Well, I think it's extremely plausible because, you know, he is this strong, heroic figure who also, because he's strong and heroic, makes a good slave and a good worker. Therefore, they want to break him rather than waste their money.
And it's all kind of like, you know, that whole bit is kind of like, you know, pour encourager les autres. You know, they want to kind of, he's held up as a kind of, this is what happens if you...
But also, there's on the Virginia slave plantation, the tobacco plantation, you see the psychology of the slave master at work, where if you as a slave transgress, you might not be punished, but the person you like.
I thought that was done really well. I thought that veneer of gentility of the kind of the British plantation owners or the expatriate British plantation, who are all kind of quite soft soap, and they've got their Irish kind of overseer to do the dirty work. And then if anyone kind of back chats or looks at them wrong, all of a sudden they're kind of the mask slips and they're very much kind of like, let's go hell for leather on these people.
Oh, black listeners can listen to the show going, this room full of white people, how did they not, what are they talking about? How can it be a shock to them? Did they not know this? Because I think we do know this stuff went on, but to be confronted with it recreated before your very eyes.
Yes, that's the horror, isn't it? You know, I mean, especially from the city that me and Andrew are from, obviously benefited...
Well, in large measure, it's built on the proceeds.
From that, you know,
Penny Lane is named after James Penny, a slaver and anti-abolitionist. So,
it is across the whole country. You know, there's the main concert hall in Bristol is called the Colston Hall, and Massive Attack have never played there and won't play there because it's named after Bristolian merchant who made a large part of his kind of fortune from the slave trade. So, you know, it's all across the country. It's not just kind of one or two isolated places. And I think this isn't, you know, I kept on thinking, why have they done this? And actually, it is really important to do it because nobody's seen that 1970s version of this story for ages. And it is important. It's kind of like being, you know, it's a reason that there is, it's important that historical things are marked, even if they're uncomfortable, because you need to keep on explain to people that this happened, because otherwise it becomes abstract.
Just to talk about the drama again for a moment, you know, one of the really striking things about it is that they've woven into it certain kind of moments of near escape, and, you know, Kunta Kinte is a warrior and he very, very nearly gets to pull off the heroic action movie escape and the heroic action movie revenge against the person who's torturing him and his friends. But of course he doesn't, because reality has no obligation to deliver, you know, a packaged movie experience where you get your cathartic escape. I mean, to me, you know, the conventional drama says, you know, when will he escape? When, you know, when will they get justice? And the drama here is, you know, they're not going to. It's just, it is relentlessly kind of, you know, harsh and kind of bleak.
Yeah, I mean, leaving aside the historical guilt, it did work. It did work in that way. The pacing.
Yeah.
Much as you think, well, we're not going to get any redemption, we're not going to get any hugs here. You know, as movie making, as filmmaking, it's tremendous. It sort of reminded me of Russian films and novels. Just absolute nihilism, yeah. Almost. But you know, you get the action, you get the adrenaline all the way through, you know. Yeah. That kind of is what keeps you going.
So are we going to stick with it? I mean, it is an ordeal. I mean, I sort of feel like owe it to the show to watch the rest of it.
I don't know. I don't know if I can cope with it. There is an alternate world where Conte, you know, he sort of like, he does escape and he comes back and he sets up a great university and it's all great. But I know that's not the case. It's unremittingly grim for that. And I'm not sure I can stick with that.
Well, listeners, give it a go. It's still on iPlayer, the remake of Roots. Let's move on with some music. Every week we ask our guest to bring in a tune that they are obsessed with at the moment, an editor's recommendation even. Joe Muggs, what have you got for us?
This is a song from an upcoming album by Justin Carter, mm-hmm. who is half of Mr. Saturday Night, who are a DJ duo from New York with Eamon Harkin. They are quite possibly the best, or among the very best, house and disco DJs in the world these days. They also throw a party. We talked about David Mancuso on the show the other week, and they, as much as anybody, represent the spirit of the loft parties. They throw daytime parties. They encourage people who are the best dancers to come. It's about the dancer, not the DJ. It's about community. They have food.
Do they put acid in the punch?
oh, wow.
No,
I'm in.
I have no idea whether they put acid in the punch. But I saw them in St. John at Hackney Church when they came to London during last summer, and it was just the best time dancing I've had in some years. Not only did they do this incredible, beautiful slow build mixing with obscure, modern and ancient house and disco and stuff, but then when they got there, they started playing stuff like a dub of True Faith by New Order, and then Immigrant Song by Led Zeppelin. Just as people were ready to cut loose, they went full dirt.
Okay, well, let's have a listen. This is Leaves by Justin Carter.
My optimism is running.
Leaves by Justin Carter, as chosen by our guest Joe Muggs. And while we're on Muggs music, sadly, this week the deaths were announced of David Axelrod, the prodigiously talented composer and musician, at the age of 83. In the late 1960s, Axelrod's music fused jazz and soul with spiritual euphoria drawn from the hippies and the acid underground. Others made psychedelic soul. Axelrod was a kind of multidimensional William Blake of orchestral transcendence. He experienced a second coming in the 90s when his music became the Crate Digger's Delight, sampled by DJ Shadow, the Beatnuts, Dr. Dre, Uncle, J. Dilla, Wu-Tang, everybody basically. We'll discuss Axelrod's life and work in a minute after this taster. From his album Songs of Experience in 1968, this is The Fly.
Hey.
That was The Fly by David Axelrod from Songs of Experience. The fantastic richness and strangeness of his music. No wonder it gets it was sampling catnip. Joe Muggs, tell me about your journey with David Axelrod.
Well, funnily enough, for many years, that sort of thing wasn't Muggs' music. I spent my 20s in Brighton, and when you're in Brighton, you are inevitably surrounded by jazz funk bores with terrible beads and terrible hats. And I was very much into jungle and techno and all those kind of things during the 90s, and I kind of frowned on the crate digging bores who wanted to tell me all about what was being sampled. I was more interested in the technology and excitement and stuff. It's only as I've kind of approached middle age that the delights of jazz soundtracks and so on have really hit home. So now I very much listen to this to Axelrod and Cannibal Adderley that he produced and all these kind of things.
Tony T, are you an Axelrod head?
I wouldn't say I'm an Axelrod head, but I certainly got into his music in the fashionable 1990s when I lived in London's fabulous London area. And obviously, like every other sort of dance music bore of the time, I was into DJ Shadow, and that's how I discovered it. But until his passing, I hadn't listened to him in years. And so yesterday, spent the time rediscovering again. And if you've got a pretentious pair of headphones, or the sort of headphones you buy in shops where a chap takes you into a second room and says, you've got to listen to these, there's great separation here, then this is the music to do fine. So I'd say there's the two key albums, which is, well, the Songs of Innocence, Songs of Experience, and it's all killer, no filler on all of them. Listened both several times yesterday, and of course there was, The Fly is this is incredible stuff, and you can see what DJ Shadow did to it. He disciplined it, he took bits of it and added excellent beats to it, but unlike a lot of fluffy jazz, it doesn't really go on and on. There is a really good groove throughout. The drums are really solid and great, this is catnip for DJs, and I think for rappers especially, it's absolutely made for hip hop.
And also because he kind of he came from the jazz scene in LA, and he worked with, as Joe said, he worked with Lou Rawls, we worked with Cannibal Adderley. He made an amazing album called Mercy, 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 which was supposed to be a live album, but was just him getting a bunch of mates in a studio in the Capitol Records building and going, yay, and then putting over a Cannibal Adderley record. But he worked with the Wrecking Crew. Were his... The Wrecking Crew drummer, Earl Palmer, was his kind of go-to drum guy, which is why those drum beats are just kind of so rocking and hardcore and, exactly what any hip-hop DJ needs. It was quite interesting. I went back and listened to some of the stuff that I hadn't listened to for ages. I listened to the David McCallum track, which basically, if you listen to it, you go, what did Dre actually do on the next episode to this track apart from put a few rappers over the top of it? Because it is almost all there.
It's an incredible argument for money in music, because this was the time when the studios were very, very expensive and the session musicians were on very good wages, and you can hear it. I mean, I've just been... Anthony was talking about great hi-fi and so on. I've been played a couple of times at Spiritland up in King's Cross, which is, this mega hi-fi bar, and really appreciating late 60s to mid 70s production. I got really into my Paul Simon albums, and it's like, oh, you can hear the money on this.
So what is it that, we talk about, Axelrod was obviously, beloved and, by two generations. What was it that made him different? Because to me, I jazz is far from my area of expertise, but to me, there aren't any contemporaries. There's nothing that actually sounds like this. It's got that cosmic element. Was it basically drugs, Joe? Was it drugs?
I'm sure that the drugs did wonderful, wonderful things. It's the sound of a one-off. I mean, Songs of Innocence, Songs of Experience. William Blake said, "I must create a system or forever be enslaved by another man." It's clear that he was attracted to William Blake because he was someone who just wanted to build his own thing, and that's what he did. He clearly worked from first principles and got good at everything he did.
I was reading a lot of appreciations about him this week, and there was one description described his stuff as liturgical, which is true because he was obsessed with the spiritual. And Joe, you're talking about kind of the money sloshing around. There was enough money to let a guy who was kind of quite obviously obsessed and a little bit oddball go off and spend a lot of money making things, you know, the electric prune stuff that he did.
Yeah,
he kind of basically did a rock mass. Yeah, and you know, and you kind of go in, you know,
and
what?
The band were unable to play it. The band ended up wandering off.
Yeah. I think if you're not a jazz person, thank God that most people aren't jazz people. What I liked about it was the discipline of it, that it doesn't go into like endless solos.
Yeah,
there are, and this may be, you know, a bit controversial, it's full of great tunes. It's full of hummable stuff. You know, it's not self-indulgent. The strings, the beats, they have a purpose. They fix it in. And if you've got good hi-fi equipment and you don't know about this stuff, because, you know, not everyone does, it's a really good way to spend an afternoon in the office with a pair of headphones on just listening to this.
Well, I've got cheap, terrible hi-fi and it sounds fantastic on that as well. So
great separation.
Obviously, this is, you know, his death at 83. It's a medium good innings. You would have hoped for a little bit more, particularly in this day and age when people make it to their mid-90s. But personally, I would think it was a shame that, you know, we'll never again hear, when we had President Barack Obama, they would introduce his chief strategist, David Axelrod.
Not that one. Can I just warn people that there are some bass solos involved? Yeah. some I did notice that yesterday. If you like Serge Gainsbourg, there is that element of that little punchy bass sound. And Air used it. And I think the excellent thing about the 90s, which were the 60s for everyone, was that people really wore their influence on their sleeve, and they took pleasure in saying, right, well, you know, we're Air and we're friends, but you've got to listen to Melody Nelson by Serge Gainsbourg. And I think that was, and the same with DJ Shadow. And it was just like, oh, wow, I didn't know about this. So,
well, it was when people had a hinterland, and I don't know, have people got a hinterland now? Is anybody carrying the Axelrod mantle? I mean, obviously we saw...
Yes.
So, who's doing it then?
The Californian beat scene. I mean, indeed, Flying Lotus and this huge, huge Californian scene. You get this kind of direct leap from Madlib, who's the experimentalist hip-hop producer's experimentalist hip-hop producer, who then begat Flying Lotus and this huge scene, the Brain Feeder label that he runs, hundreds of these guys, and they're very much in this Californian cosmic tradition, huge ambition, very, very strange.
And I think you've also got to kind of like give a kind of a shout out to people like kind of Giles Peterson, who I first kind of got into this stuff when I was listening to him with Air and all that kind of stuff in the 90s, and he's still doing that, you know, he's still going out there and finding kind of weird shit, you know.
At the hinterland, I spoke to Giles Peterson recently, and he said that the most successful compilation he's done in the past, I think it was 5 years, is his Sun Ra compilation, sells in bucket loads. So yes, the kids like the weird stuff.
Will you do us a favour? I'm challenging you on the show, Muggs. Will you do a Cosmic California playlist on Spotify, and we can bung it up on the Facebook page for the viewers?
I can do that.
Excellent.
Okay. Both records.
Yeah, it's two records, and it goes on for like nine hours.
Just two tracks.
Well, no, weirdly, because these are kids brought up on beat tapes, most of the tracks are, well, a lot of the tracks are 1 minute 30. Oh. So it's hip-hop and cosmic.
Absolutely, keep it brief. All right, then. So let's get back to the present day with Anthony Teasdale's choice of music. What have you brought for us, Tony T?
I have bought the household name, Ahmed Fakhroun.
Oh, yes.
We talk of nothing else where we live. I heard this on the fashionable online music thing, Spotify. It was put together by Test Pressing. Now, I don't know if you're aware of Test Pressing. Now, for those of us of a Balearic nature, and I mean that in the, you know, Ibiza 1986 thing rather than, you know, San An, let's have it scene. There is nothing better than hearing a chap talk in a foreign language with a funky beat behind it. And if you like that, this is the record for you. It's called Nisyan. I have no idea. He's singing in Arabic. And our friend Ahmed is from Libya. And reading up on Wikipedia, because I'm not going to pretend I knew anything about this bloke before this morning. I just like the track. he is a, like a multi. He's a Rai singer.
Rai as an R-A-I or
yeah,
as
I mean, he looks with his arches his eyebrow at the camera and says,
really?
But he produces absolutely fab, funky music. And I think what I love about Balearic is the less fashionable the artist, the better. There was never that thing in Balearic which was like, well, he's done it and I don't like him. It was always about the individual record. I don't care what they've done before. It's irrelevant to me. Is the song funky? Is it good? Yes. And this record is fab.
Well, let's find out. This is Ahmed Fakhroun with Nizian. That was Ahmed Fakhroun. Who was it, Tony?
It's Ahmed Fakhroun.
There you go.
From Kirby, a Kirby lad.
Matt was delighted at the pronunciation there. Nizian by Ahmed Fakhroun, choice of our guest, Anthony Teasdale. Now, let's talk about a new record, a brand new one. The British new soul artist...
Not on this show. Short shrift.
Absolutely, yeah. So, Sampha Cissé. Am I pronouncing that right, Joe? San Francisco? Who knows? He's been high on the target list for artists who need a shot of pathos in their big radio hits. Sampha has guested on tracks by Drake, Kanye West and Beyonce, and he's worked extensively on Solange Knowles' album, A Seat at the Table. His debut album, Process, is out now, and it distills everything that's in the air right now. Wounded emotions, subdued textures, the most undemonstrative soul music imaginable. What do our guests make of it? Let's find out after this taster from Process. This is Sampha, Blood on Me. Sampha and Blood on Me from his debut album Process. That's probably the biggest statement track there on a very introspective album. I was expecting this to be a really boring record, and it's not. It's dead funky. Joe, this is in your area. Tell us about Sampha.
Yeah, I mean, he's been kicking around for 7 or 8 years, you know, guesting with a lot of the British bass music, post-dubstep generation, as they were called. You know, he's clearly earned his stripes and worked his chops out and all those things that musicians are supposed to do. And, you know, he's now super accomplished. And he's part of this whole wave of sensitive English souls, heavily influencing the American mainstream. I mean, along with James Blake, Blood Orange, The XX. Yeah. You know, these are guys who pop up again and again and again on Beyonce and Drake and such, so forth.
So like I say, I approached this with some trepidation because I really do not have a lot of time for today's introspective, poor me, you know, kind of. It just seems to be a very monotone, beige, emotional palette. And yet this, I think, is, I mean, there are a lot of, you know, beatless and pretty slowed down things. But this actually, I think, has got the soul as well as the sensitivity. Do you think that's to do with his background in, you know, house stuff?
I don't know. It's very difficult to tell. There's this whole blurring. I mean, you know, the XX are a great example. They are a post-dubstep band as well.
Yeah.
So super bedroom indie sensibility, but able to bring it into essentially clubbers' world.
Yeah.
James Blake, again, you know, he comes from both this ultra-sensitive Joni Mitchell fan angle, but also from playing dubstep records at terrifying volume at DMZ. And... I think it's natural. I think this is what we used to use the cliche of the iPod generation. This is a generation for whom it is completely natural to use that sound system impact and sensitive songwriting. The choked vocal style I still stumble over sometimes.
I'm getting really sick of it.
You know, Sam Smith is probably the worst example where it constantly kind of breaks into this weird parrot squawk. You know,
Sam Smith's better.
There are people who do the sensitive geezer thing well, and people who don't. And you know, Sampha is definitely on the James Blake side. Rather, actually, I can't. Someone, one of him or one of his collaborators, told me off for saying he sounded like James Blake once on Twitter. But you know, they're in the same ballpark, and they both do it through good great vocal control.
That was the don't mention James Blake alarm we're talking about down there, the Twitter alert. Anthony Teasdale, what do you think of this?
Well, I thought it was great. Really good headphone music again. I know I'm saying this today quite a lot and it's pretty tedious, but it is. I felt very, very intimate. He was speaking directly to you, like over your shoulder, like, you know, like a fella in the pub talking over your shoulder, very sensitively. And I like the
what
piano.
What pubs are you going to?
I go to 80s fun pubs. I loved the piano and it felt quite acoustic. I just thought it was, you know, it's full of text, very textual. God, I sound pretentious, but it was. There was lots of space in it. My favourite record was has loads of space, individual bits that are really good, but not an assault of noise. And I thought you got all the elements here really, really well. And I thought it was very accessible as well. You put it on. I listened to it 3 times over the last few days. Yeah, it's absolutely great. And, you know, I'd say give it a go.
There's a great feature of The Guardian by Harriet Gibson where she goes, I mean, this is not a bloke emoting artificially. He's had a pretty miserable run of things. You know, dad died of cancer, older brother disabled by a stroke, mum died in 2015 when he's making this record. You know, it's clearly not X Factor method emotion, is it? He's got a lot on his
Far be it from me, and I don't think he should suck it up, but it is a little bit, you know, he's also kind of like, you know, hanging out with Kanye and Drake's buying his beats, and you know he's not living the worst life in the world.
No, I know,
I just think, you know, I'm bored of this stuff.
But
I can't get over the fact that he's just a, you know, there's just so many of these kind of man babies saying it's not my fault, and you know it just gets like,
yeah,
oh my
man
God.
Up, Sam, for man, up, man great, up, Frank Ocean.
Great to. If you were lucky enough to avail yourself of a young lady for the evening, if you put this on, she would obviously think this guy's really, really very sensitive.
Or she'd see right through you.
Yeah, do you know what I mean? If you, like, you know, in the 80s, you bring someone back, it's Sade.
Yeah.
You bring this on, I said, well, I'm actually very serious. Look, it's a shoe-in, gent. Get it on the stereo.
There speaks a former deputy editor of FHM magazine with the hints and the tips. Yes.
It's not the absolute fraudulent boo-hoo poor me of Drake and The Weeknd where it's oh, God, I feel guilty because I've had so many groupies this week.
Yeah.
You know, it's,
and
it's,
wading
it's,
through cocaine.
A common problem.
It's a far more British misery.
Yes,
you know,
it is.
It's much more, you know, it's like The Cure. It's like Depeche Mode. I mean, what's really wonderful is that when you look at artists like him, like Blood Orange, like Emily Sandé on a more sort of populist
on a good
level.
Day, yes.
Well, yeah, I mean, you do hear a bit of Emily Sandé Heaven in a couple of, which is, you know, her one good tune in some of this. But you, what we seem to be doing really well is that black British artists don't have to be big quote marks black artists at all, you know. This is there is no longer a cliche thing. I mean, you know, you look at that horror back in the early 80s when Julie Burchill accused Prince and Sade of being quote beige because they weren't doing proper black music, and that is no longer the expectation. You know, an artist like him can do this and not have to be one or the other.
Okay, the clock is running down and it's time to do closing time chatter, where our guests share the stories or the ideas or the features or the arguments or whatever that's been getting their goat this week. Anthony Teasdale, what's been concerning you?
Brutalism.
Brutalism, why is that?
Our magazine has constantly sort of pushed a brutalist aesthetic in our shots. We've always loved architecture and it happens to look really good in pictures. But coming from...
Anton Corbin.
Yes.
Black and white concrete, yes.
Coming from a semi-detached house in a normal suburb, I didn't actually have to live in a brutalist house. And what you find, the love of brutalism is inverse to the connection you had with it.
Yes.
Do you know what I mean? So if you grew up in Skelmersdale or Kirby or something like that, then, you know, you can't really get romantic about the Concourse shopping centre.
No, because you think of the smell of wee and old chip.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And there is a lot of brutalism, but for especially in England where it rains a lot, it can be really grim. And we ran a thing where someone who'd actually grown up in a brutalist block of flats said it was terrible and I couldn't wait to escape.
Was it that... isn't it that band, the Magnetic North, one of whom actually grew up in Skem, didn't they?
Yeah.
And they did a thing last year where they went back and it was a kind of suite for Skelmersdale, wasn't it?
Yeah. Was it about
Skem Manifesto?
So yes, I think they do look good, and you know, I mean, the Barbican is great, but it is full of really rich people and it's still hard to get around. And if it was in a field in Northamptonshire, I'm not totally convinced it would be seen as the success that it is.
Joe Muggs, what have you got for us on the Closing Time chatter front?
10 hours of an icebreaker trapped in Arctic ice.
Can you explain this in a little bit more detail, please?
Someone set up their field recording kit on a Norwegian icebreaker stuck in the Arctic ice. And left it running for 10 hours, and it's on YouTube now.
Why did they do this?
Because it sounds amazing.
They're male, aren't they?
I love ambient music. I talked about my love of ambient music, but my God, this immersive experience you get, it's so perfect. You get this full frequency range from literally, it's so sensitively recorded, you get the flutter of snowflakes all the way down to these tectonic cracks in the ice and this kind of hum of the icebreaker ship's motor. And it's just the most blissfully relaxing thing you could ever hear. I cannot recommend this enough. Apparently, at some point around the 4-hour mark, you hear someone in Norwegian go, "Is the tape still rolling?"
I haven't found this yet.
Do you also hear the sound of kind of Norwegians going slightly mad? Are we out of here yet?
Is this on YouTube then?
It's on YouTube. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah,
what are the visuals?
Just photos of white. The icebreaker sitting there, just white. Snow fluttering.
What are they doing for the next LP?
The extended remix.
So not a radio edit then. Under what circumstances do you listen to this, Joe? You just put it on when you're pottering around the house. Turn the heating off.
On headphones when you're about to go to sleep. When you're actually asleep. I've had it pottering around the house. It's amazing. I mean, the sound of ice cracking is one of the most incredible sounds. So a friend of mine actually played the sounds of glaciers cracking in room one at Fabric. Once.
Not nor Bali.
well, Norway.
Well, Norway. Matt, what's your closing time chatter?
Two very quick things. One, I can't be the only person who's disappointed that the Chris Morris that's made a show on Radio 4 called Brexit, A Guide for the Perplexed, isn't Chris Morris. I was really disappointed. I actually listened to the first 30 seconds and then realised it wasn't going to go the way that I thought it was. Yeah. But the other thing is I've discovered, and I'm sure everyone else has seen this, but knowyourmeme.com, which is the international meme database, which enables you, and they just list everything that is kind of memeing on the internet. So you go through everything from politics, so Sean Spicer's alphabet of completely made up words that he's managed to deliver in 2 weeks at the White House lectern, and the Catch Me Outside girl, which you might have come across, Joe, but just kind of a very strange, weird collection of stuff.
I'm still stuck on Salt Bay.
Otherwise, I would never have seen.
Well, my closing time chatter, just a very short one. I just wanted to mention the death of Alan Simpson, of Goldman Simpson. Terribly sad. It seems like the end of an era when there was an actual shared British sense of humour that everybody could participate in. There wasn't the Friday night Channel 4 sense of humour and the mainstream BBC One sense of humour.
Never watched Mrs Brown's Boys?
Yeah, I don't share that sense of humour. I don't think it's very funny, you know. But whereas Steptoe, the whole of... Maybe society was less varied at the time, I don't know.
I hardly watch any comedy anymore.
Well, me neither. That's what I'm saying. He represented a time. Hancock, Steptoe and all the other bits around the side was a time when... the sense of humour was a unifying thing. Now you've got your BBC Four viewers, we watch Curb Your Enthusiasm, you've got your E4 viewers with Brooklyn Nine-Nine, and you've got your Modern Family, you've got all this stuff from everywhere.
I think this is a bit revisionism, because, you know, even when there was Steptoe and somewhere on, you know, Dick Emery was on as well, and there was a whole, you know, that was a British sense of humour. That
it was awful.
Boom, boom, tish.
But, I mean, Steptoe would get, like, 30 million viewers.
Yeah, there was nothing else.
I'm not 30, 20 million. I'm not disagreeing that it was partly because there's nothing else on, but the fact that there was nothing else on was reinforced the comedy. It kind of brought everybody together and actually created our comic sensibility. Whereas now, my favourite comedies. Many members of my family don't even know what they are. So I just wanted to mark...
And our shared sensibility was mutual loathing. I mean, Steptoe, yeah. Hancock, yes. All the way through 40 Towers. You know, it's about being trapped with people you loathe.
Well, actually, and now, of course, you're not trapped with anybody because you can just disappear into your own little privately cultivated, curated world. And
that is it.
Tell you, and they'll be happy in your echo chamber.
And it's music and it's comedy or whatever it is. And you choose that and yeah. that's it.
We Tony's actually had his headphones on the whole way through this show. Yeah. And been listening to something completely different.
With amazing, to, amazing separation.
Farouk.
Yeah, Farouk, yeah. Okay, so I think that's our show. That's another one in the bag. Thank you for listening to our 40th regular show. Specials not included. Thanks to our guests, Anthony Teasdale of Umbrella Magazine. Thank you, Tony T, for
thank
coming
you.
In.
A pleasure.
Thank you to Joe Muggs of Mixed Mag Fact, The Guardian, and absolutely everything else. Thank you, Joe.
Thank you very much.
And remember, you can hear this episode of Big Mouth again, and in fact, all of our archive shows at audioboom.com/channel/BigMouth. If you head over there, you can hear our spoiler-packed Trainspotting 2 minicast, plus roundups of everything from Rogue One to La La Land to the new Elbow album and loads of Bowie. You can also subscribe at iTunes. Just go to the podcast section of the iTunes Music Store, search for Big Mouth and subscribe. And of course, please leave us 5-star ratings because you love the show, don't you? If you subscribe, we'll send you the podcast version on Saturday, not Sunday, so that you can get the jump on it. Matt and I will be back on SohoRadioLondon.com at 9 a.m. next Sunday with more guests and more stuff. Thank you very much for listening, and we'll see you then. Bye-bye.